Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation, recorded live during the 2018 Home Education Conference, held in Williamsburg, Virginia.
For those of you who don't know, I did my bachelor's with Weber State University in Utah. I did my master's with Capella University in counseling psychology. And then I do have a year specialization certificate in addiction therapy. And I did all my internships with the County Mental Health Program, because you will see everything you never knew you wanted to see. And right now, I've worked for residential treatment centers, which specifically for adolescents. And right now, I work with a small program that deals specifically with adolescents in the juvenile justice system in custody of the state. So we see a lot of things. We're going to jump right in because there's a lot to this topic. And if you have questions, raise your hands and ask me. I am perfectly happy to answer them. If you have more questions, I'll stay after and you can answer. So when we talk about adolescents, we talk about that sometimes people call it a tumultuous time. There is lots going on. My grandmother once told me the only difference between an adolescent and a two-year-old is the vocabulary, and it's because the two-year-old has a better vocabulary. So there's a lot going on. There are physical changes. We have the, am I going to get any taller? Or am I going to stop growing? You know, for some of our kids. You know, for some of our boys, is my voice ever going to stop cracking? Happens for some of our girls. Why is your hair greasy? Why is your face greasy? Am I even going to grow hair on my face? You know, there are lots of different stuff. Anybody here remember being a teenager? I try not to, because I don't want to, you know. People ask, would you ever go back to being a teenager? No, I'll pass. And the ever favorite, please go shower, because you stink. I'm sure no one's ever told their teenager to go shower. So I like this picture of The Breakfast Club. I know it's not the best movie, but at the time, you know, it was a long time ago. But it gives you kind of an idea of all the different stuff. You know, there's different teenagers for everything. You've got your nerd, you've got your super popular girl, you've got your one that doesn't fit in, you've got your jock, and you've got your degenerate, as some people would call them. Kids fit lots of different gamuts and different things at the same time. So along with all these physical changes, they have lots of mental changes going on. It's not just their body that's growing. They have the phase of, yay, I'm an adult, but I'm not really an adult. I'm sort of am making more choices, but I don't have that full freedom. You know, they have lots of different responsibilities. Many of them have work. They have school. They have church responsibilities. There's a lot they have to do that we as adults go, well, that's not that much. You know, we do this all the time. But for them, you know, they've gone from just playing and maybe some schoolwork to a lot more stuff to do. And in particular, youth with high values, they stand out. They are different. They're going to stand out in a crowd by their dress. They're going to stand out in a crowd by the way they talk, by the things they talk about. So they're different. So adolescents have lots of life-changing choices that are going on. Lots and lots of choices. They're talking about missions. They're talking about colleges. You know, which college do I go to? This one? Do I go to a BYU? Do I go to a not BYU? Do I go to school and stay at home? You know, there's lots and lots of choices that they're making, and it's starting earlier and earlier. It used to be really not till like your junior year you started looking in your senior year. Now people are starting at looking when kids are in preschool. Oh, well, you know, if you want to go to this school, we've got to put you on this track, and all these things have to be met. It's a very different world. They also are looking at career choices. Along with that, going to college, what do I want to do with the rest of my life? You know, the average adult has four careers, whether they be male or female. They have an average of four, so it's a lot of choices. And then comes into effect relationships. Relationships with friends, relationships with family members, relationships with members of the opposite sex. there's lots of different learning how to have healthy relationships, what it looks like, and what's not. I really love this comic. My husband found it, and I thought it was one of the funniest ones I've seen in a long time. It's the three little bears, and instead of three little chairs, they have three little computers. And it says, "And who's been trolling through my personal information?" How many data breaches do we see lately? You know, how many times do we see parents are warned of a new app? Take example when Snapchat came out. For a long time, parents didn't realize you can pull that up and you can see where your friends are, which is great if they're your friends, but what happens if they're not your friends? You know, that personal information is a lot more easy to access than it used to be. This generation's different. So when you think about kids between the ages of 12 and 18, they were born between 1990 and 2006. So what's happened? What's occurred since they were born? 9/11. You know, that's a huge impact on them. It made a huge impact on our country. The housing market. We had the peak in 2006, and then the crash in 2008, and then a slight crash in 2012 again. And we think that might not have, you know, we think as adults, well, that doesn't impact kids, but it does, because it impacts the entire society. So we look at, we had a president impeached. We have a huge, you know, you look at how we treat political offices, you know, 20 years ago versus how we treat them now. These are what these kids are seeing. They have a frequent disruption from technology. They're going along doing their homework. Ding! Your phone goes, oh, I'm going to transition from this to this. How many times have you been in a church meeting or any kind of meeting and someone's cell phone goes off? Does it disrupt things? You know, our brains work in certain ways, and that kind of, that interrupts it. We have lots and lots of privacy invasions, privacy breaches. Things are not private anymore that used to be. We have lots of wars and bombings, lots and lots. Lots of school shootings. Sadly, there was one this morning. I mean, it's an epidemic. It's not a simple thing. So keep in mind that kids that have grown up in this area have not had the same level of stability you guys did. They haven't had this same, you know, we have more and more families that aren't together. They've grown up in a world where, and I like this comic where he's got like five things all at the same time because we're trying to balance how many different things at once. They haven't grown up, you know, communication comes, it's not just a phone call anymore. It's a phone call, it's an email, it's a letter, it's a text message, it's a blog post. Tons and tons of information is being shoved at these kids at the same time, and it's not value shift all the time. What society thought was acceptable 10 years ago is not the same. You can even look just in the mental health field. You look at, so we use a book called the DSM. It's how therapists diagnose, or any health professional, any mental health professional diagnose. You look at what was acceptable as a diagnosis in version 2 versus 5, and they're radically different. Version 2 is like this thick, version 5 is like this thick. Very, very different. So all these things are changing. You know, this, just to give you guys an instance, and I'm not going to go over each one, but just to give you guys some of the things that our kids are seeing on the news, in the media, these are all just terrorist-related shootings. And here's the slide that sucks. I'm going to give you that fair warning first. This one's just bombings and stabbings and arsons from the time these kids have been little till now. And the reason I bring you stuff like this is we get barraged with it so much, we don't think about the long-term effect that it has on our youth. Just looking at the DC metro area, you have 9/11, you had the serial sniper, you have had hurricanes. How many times in the news do you see a metro car fire? It happens, but these things as a whole impact our youth and they impact our families individually. So what are parents facing? Besides giant teenagers that now take up the entire couch. I love this. I didn't know I gave birth to something that could be this big. I'm pretty sure when my son was born that I thought I was gonna die. He was so big. So what are you guys facing as parents? Depression. There is increased rates of depression. Increased rates of anxiety and panic attacks. Increased trauma. increased eating disorders and body images. And I'll tell you, that's not just in girls. The same thing does happen in boys. Bullying and self-harming and increased rates of suicide. Right now in Utah, and I only know this because I saw the article a couple weeks ago, the CDC has declared it an official epidemic, their suicide rate. It is so high. So, and believe it or not, most mental disorders start in teenagers. We see the starts of most mental health disorders between the ages of 12 and 24. So you guys are at prime exposure rate. So the first one we're going to talk about is generalized anxiety disorder. We shorten it to GAD because we're lazy therapists. But it often is one that develops really kind of slow. It starts in the teenage years and goes on into adulthood. You don't have a ton about it. But I like this comic. I can't keep calm. I have anxiety. So what do we look for when we talk about generalized anxiety disorder? We talk about that our youth are worrying about things every day and tremendously. It's not, and they're worrying about everything. It's not just, I have a big presentation I'm teaching at the homeschool conference. That's a perfectly normal thing to worry about. It's, I'm worrying about whether my laundry's gonna be done in time. I'm worrying about if this shirt's okay. You know, it's excessive. It's not just a standard, you know, something is that's okay. They have trouble controlling that worry and that anxiousness. And sometimes it comes out in lots of different ways. Most of the time when you talk to them, they know they're stressing more than they should, but they don't know what to do about it. If you ask them, you know, are you worried about this? Yeah, I know I shouldn't be worried, but I am. Worrying about things that, you know, did you lock the door tonight, Mom? You know, that's really mostly an adult worry. If they're coming in after you, sure, throw that deadbolt. But when they're staying up at night worrying about things like that, it's time to start kind of ask questions. They're restless. You'll see them in their seats and they're kind of just fidgeting and they can't really sit still. And kind of, you'll tell them, calm down, relax. And they're like, I can't relax. I'm just up all the time. They have a really hard time concentrating when they're anxious. You know, you might give them some math to do. And you know it should only take them 20 minutes, and 2 hours later, they're still doing that same math. Because instead of their mind being focused on that math, it's running through the thoughts that are running through their head. They can be really easily startled. You might come up while they're doing that math assignment and tap them on the shoulder, and they're like, ah, what did you do that for? It's that over-startalization response that you're kind of looking at going, oh, well, don't punch Mom when I ask you a question, but thanks for sharing. Anxious kids have a really hard time sleeping. They either have trouble getting to sleep or they have trouble staying asleep. Because once they lay down, their body's not busy, so their mind gets going and keeps going. Sometimes you can have them write stuff down and it will help. Or even if they get to sleep, you'll find them up at like 2, 4, 5 in the morning because they couldn't stay asleep. It's a really common thing that you see with anxious kids. They're tired because they're not sleeping. And they're tired all the time. And things that you wouldn't think would make them tired are exhausting to them. Because part of that anxiety is they tense their body and it tenses their muscles. And if you walk around like this all day, after a little while, your shoulders are going to hurt, your head's going to hurt, your neck's going to hurt. And when your body is that tight, it makes you tired. And along with it, with anxiety, you see very physical symptoms. You'll see headaches. Really, really common. So common now that my pediatrician, anytime someone brings in a kid over the age of 12, will ask, do you have stomach aches? Especially when it's not related to everybody in the family got food poisoning or everybody has the flu. But just random stomach aches, it's a really common problem. Muscle aches and lots of headaches. So, along with GAD, we talk, I like this one. What if? What are we doing? Sometimes you'll see such a physical symptom that they have a hard time swallowing. That they'll say, I don't really want to eat, my throat hurts, I can't swallow. Because again, that goes with that body tension, that muscle tension. you'll see them sometimes, they have a tremor or a twitch. They're very, you know, they just can't sit still. Our bodies are these powerful things, and what's going on in our head does come out. Sometimes with anxious kids, you'll see that they'll tell you they're anxious. Sometimes they're just grouchy. I like to think of them as like a little prickly pear. You're not, you know, a little porcupine walking along that if you don't pet it just right, it's going to stand up and spike you. They're irritable like that. It might be something as simple as you're driving along in the car and you decided to turn the radio on. And here comes your kid. Mom, why did you turn that on? How do you not know I can't stand noise in the car? You know, very simple things that to them aren't simple, but to you they might be. So they can be very, very cranky. They'll sweat a lot when they're anxious. Not that it makes so much a difference out here where it's humid and everyone sweats, but you know, you can look at one kid sitting there and you're like, oh, that entire chair is wet. Someone's a little nervous. You know, it's a common reaction of when we're nervous to sweat. They'll talk about being really lightheaded or out of breath. And I know these are a lot of symptoms. And sometimes you'll find they have to go to the bathroom a lot. And that goes along with that anxiety. It causes nausea, diarrhea. And sometimes they do that just to get a break from everything else. Because the bathroom's kind of an enclosed space in many places and it's quiet. Kids with GAD worry excessively about school, sports. Maybe they're trying out for a piano recital and they'll spend hours and hours and hours practicing a piece. And you can hear them, they're playing fantastic. And they're still super worried about it. They also worry about things going on in the world, like maybe there's an earthquake in Chile and for the next couple of weeks, your anxious kid will tell you, Mom, are you sure we're not gonna have an earthquake in Virginia? Are you sure, Mom? It's not a common thing. Now, if you ask about a hurricane, sure, why not? But, you know, probably not going to have an earthquake that common. So, the next one we're going to go on to, if anybody has any questions about GAD, you're welcome to ask him now. Otherwise, we'll go on to social. Sure, go ahead.
So, we may have covered this. I came in from this.
No, it's okay.
How do these things kind of start? Like, what is the trigger? Like, if you're saying GAD starts in teenagers, like, I mean, what are some things we can watch for, some things we can try to...
So the biggest component that we notice with most mental health, there is a strong genetic component. But, so that being said, if it's not directly, if dad has it, kid has it. It can be great aunt Sue has it and Uncle Charlie over here does. Mental health disorders are kind of funky that way in that there's no direct way we can say this causes this. We can see what's called a correlation, where it means groups of symptoms kind of occur at the same time, but there's no specific reason that says. I can give you an example from my own family. My dad's had depression since I was a tiny kid. It's been on meds for years. I don't have it. My brother doesn't have it, but it shows up in my children. So that's kind of the thing of, it jumps around. And with any mental health disorder, there can sometimes be clear things if there's trauma involved. Anytime you throw in trauma, everything's different. But unfortunately, with most mental health, there is no rhyme or reason to when it starts. We can give generalizations like, in some things we can say, most of these occur before this point in your life. Like generally, if you reach 30 and it hasn't occurred, it might not, but there's just no specific, sadly. All right, so. Does anybody else have any questions before we go on to social anxiety disorder? So, social anxiety disorder. Oh, sure, go ahead.
If it's showing up before teenagers?
It happens.
Does that mean it's more severe?
So it depends on what it is. But yes, some of these do show up before teenage years. You can see markers earlier on. It can be more severe, but if it shows the early... So with any mental health, the earlier you get treatment, the better the outcome. Because part of it's the physical piece with the body, but the other part is also learned behaviors. And the sooner you can get help with the learned behaviors, the easier it is later on. So it does show up sooner. It's not as common. Anybody else have a question I missed? All right, let's go on to social anxiety disorder. So sometimes it's called social phobia. and I love Poor Charlie Brown, His Anxieties Have Anxieties. So when we talk about social anxiety disorder, we talked about, you know, it's a fear of like social situations or performance situations. It's where they have this idea in their head that no matter what they do, people are going to judge them, they're going to reject them, they're going to offend someone else standing in front of them. And we see this one definitely on the rise in adolescence, that the social anxiety is higher than it used to be. There's no direct studies that says this is what's causing it. The newer studies are starting to say that there may be some social media has some impact, but there's no direct link yet. So when we talk about it, it's being really, really anxious around people. Socially anxious people, you will find being in a group setting like this would have them sweating buckets. It's hard. Asking them to get up in front like this and talk, they'd be curled up in a ball on the floor going, no, 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 thank you. They're very, very self-conscious in front of other people. And that's actually kind of, sometimes it just happens with adolescents in general. They're, you know, they have in their heads, everyone's judging me. They're afraid others are going to judge them. They worry for days and weeks about social events. They worry, you know, I've got to go to girls' camp, and I'm going to worry for weeks and weeks and weeks about it. Or I've got to go to Boy Scout camp, and I'm going to worry for weeks and weeks and weeks. They get very, very nervous. And they will avoid social places. If the idea, you know, I don't want to go to the homeschool conference, Mom, then I have to talk to people. I'm sure nobody's ever heard that one before. They have a hard time making friends and keeping the friends that they do make because they don't like that social interaction. It's hard for them. They sweat, they'll tremble around other people, they'll stop talking. You know, we have a piece of this called selective mutism where they just absolutely do not talk around other people, period. It could be them, they need to tell you to call their mom and they're not going to do that. You know, even if it involves helping themselves, they won't. They get really nauseous and sick when other people are around, if it's outside of what they consider a safe social circle. Before I move on from that one, does anybody have any questions? All right, we're going to go on to depression. This is my sad little depressed person from Hyperbole and a Half that wants to fall off the couch. So when we talk about depression, we talk that depression is a sad mood most of the day, nearly every day. It's not just my pet died and I'm sad for a couple of weeks. That's a normal level of sadness. This is, no matter what, I'm just sad. When you see depression, especially with teenagers coming up, you'll see this kid loves to play the piano and all of a sudden stops. Or they love to read books. And now they don't want to go to the library anymore. They give up the things that they're interested in, their hobbies, the things you're used to seeing them do that they love to do. You'll see that in some people, when they're depressed enough, they don't even have energy for basic hygiene, showering, changing sheets, getting dressed, eating. You know, the further you go down that depression lane, the harder it gets for just simple things. You'll find with depressed people, they're fidgety. They'll pick at their clothes, they'll pick at their skin. You'll see that they're very fidgety and restless, and you'll notice maybe a scab that keeps popping up repeatedly because they just pick at it. You'll notice a weight loss or a weight gain, and when we talk about it, we talk about at least 5% or more, and generally pretty quickly. You'll notice like, look, Mom, I lost 25 pounds in 1 month. And you go, that's not a good thing. Or, you know, an excessive weight gain. And that comes with the refusing to eat or eating too much. And you'll see a giant rise in appetite or a giant decrease. Well, what did you eat today? I had ice cream. Well, when did you have ice cream? Yesterday, or I ate the entire loaf of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and all the ramen and the bag of carrots. You know, you'll see that increase or decrease. you'll see that they talk about they don't feel like they're worthwhile. I shouldn't be here. They feel guilty for things that they shouldn't. The dog barfed on the carpet, so that's my fault. You know, I made the dog barf. It guilt over things that they have no part in or things that they aren't responsible for is something you see in a lot of depressed people. You'll see problems thinking, like simple math equations that they might have done easily before, they'll struggle with. You'll see problems in concentration, giving them something to do and you're like, you could have done this overnight a couple weeks ago, what's going on? You know, they just can't focus. Again, along with anxiety, which is kind of a hard one because you see this, some symptoms cross both boundaries. You'll see stomach aches and headaches. Along with depression, especially as they get farther down that road, you'll hear thoughts of death like, I don't want to be here, I shouldn't be here. You'll hear suicidal ideas with or without a plan to do anything about it. You see a lot of it. Along with depression, it does lead to suicidal attempts if left untreated. It does go there. Self-harm. This is my sad little self-harm man. He cut his thumb. And I think this is an important piece to talk about with depression because self-harm can go hand in hand with it. So each year, at least 1 in 5 females and 1 in 7 males engage in self-injury. So when you look at a group of like 100 kids, these are the numbers you're gonna see. And this is what we know about. And I will tell you outright, this is just what we know. It's not how prevalent it is. 90% of people who engage in self-harm behavior began in their teenage years or before. So when we talk about self-harm, it's a lot more common than what people realize. And boys and girls self-harm differently. Nearly all of those who use self-harm have been sexually abused. Nearly 50%, which is huge. You figure half of the people that do have been sexually abused. That's a pretty big number. 60% of girls will engage in some kind of self-injurious behavior when they fall in that depression window, whether we see it or not. And 50% start when they start around 14, carry it all the way into their 20s. So you're talking 6 years. That's a lot of scars. And many of those who do self-injure, so the reports we do have, because this is kind of one where you don't get a lot of really good numbers, these are the best we have, but those that do self-injure report they learned it from friends or from websites. Now, how much of that is accurate, we still don't know. But there's roughly 2 million cases reported in just the U.S. every year. Those are the ones that we can confirm for sure they are. It's a lot of cases. So,
question.
Sure.
Sorry.
No, you're fine.
I feel like we've heard about this, but like, why do people do it? Like, what's the psychology behind it?
So, it can be a lot of different things. So, why people do it? Different answer for. Obviously, when we talk about kids that have been sexually abused, it's generally. It helps to cope with the pain. But a lot of times in self-harm, when I can just tell you from personal experience, when I ask kids, why did you do that? I had one 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago that I had to go to the ER for. And I was there evaluating him. I'm like, why did you do this? He's like, I was just so anxious and depressed about this. It was the only thing I could think to do. And I'm like, did it even help? Yeah. I feel better. It's a physical way to express that emotional pain, which is why it's so prevalent. How it starts, it can sometimes, you know, sometimes it's as simple as they're goofing off with the cat and they're anxious and upset and the cat scratches them and it's like, oh, that feels better. You know, it can be anything simple. There's no cut and dry that says this leads to this. It's a release of emotion. Mm-hmm. Self-harm causes a release of emotion.
And then once they start, it can become an addiction, right?
Because very much.
Hormones
that are released. Once they start, it can be very addicting, which is why it can continue for such a long time.
So So I'm a little bit naive. So are we talking about like cutting on yourself?
We're talking about, well, it's different. So in girls, you'll often see cutting. But in boys, you see other things like they'll hit themselves. They'll purposely do jump off a roof because the pain of landing will hurt. It's different with different, like you're talking cutting,
and it's not like suicide cutting.
No, self-harm can be part of suicide, but most of the time it's done as an emotional release. It's to get over whatever emotional thing they haven't dealt with and process through. And this is why we close the door.
With all of this, are you going to be giving some tips?
Yes, okay. We definitely will. I'm going to give you guys what to look for first, because as a parent, you need to know what you're looking for. You know, you need to know that when something comes along, and the number one thing I will tell you, trust your gut. If you think something's going on, it probably is. You know, you were given these children for a reason. So if you think there's something wrong, there probably is. Trust your gut and ask. It's always the number one thing I tell parents.
Sorry.
No, you're fine.
And now I think you have to, even when you don't think something's wrong,
yeah,
learn the hard way.
Yeah.
And so now,
you have to ask.
So good to know these things, because kids are so good at hiding.
Oh, yeah.
And so now you have to really, like, even when they seem fine, you still need to ask the questions.
Oh, you do. And believe it or not, a lot of times if you ask, they really will tell you.
They're terrified.
And I will tell you, a big important thing is your game face. You need, and this sounds silly, but you need to find a mirror and think about some of the worst things your kid can tell you and watch your reaction. Because what your child's looking for when they tell you this is they're looking for you to listen. And they're looking for you to sit, not turn around and say, well, how could you, and you're awful. They're looking for you to say, okay, I hear you, keep talking. I love you, we'll find a way. But if they see on your face this look of, oh my gosh, they're not gonna tell you again. And sometimes, even if you aren't, they still won't tell you. You have to find them someone else to talk to. Because sometimes they'll talk to you, sometimes they won't. You know, teenagers are kind of funny. So if you're looking at kids, one of the biggest signs that self-harming is happening that you don't know about is you'll find them, and this is also another one for self-esteem just in general, you'll find them wearing concealing clothing when it's not appropriate. Like, it's 100 degrees outside, and your kid's got long pants and a hoodie on and is sweating buckets and never takes said outfit off. You know, you might wonder, ask, is it a self-harming thing or is it a self-esteem thing? But ask, oh, you look really hot. How come you don't take your hoodie off? I have one that wears her hoodie all year round because that's her comfort blanket. You know, you think about Charlie Brown and Linus with his blue blanket. Hers is her hooded sweatshirt. That's her armor she puts on. But how I know is I ask. You know, how did you get here? So one of the things you look for is like long sleeves in hot weather, you know, avoiding places that, situations where, you know, they avoid going to the pool because they're cutting on their legs or their arms and you can't see it. If they're going to the pool and they're in a swimsuit, you're gonna notice that. Complaints of accidents that really don't fit. Anybody ever seen what a cat scratch looks like? Like, you know, you got weird marks. It doesn't look like this. But they might tell you, oh, the cat scratched me. Okay, the first time it happened, maybe, but the fifth and sixth and seventh time, it's time to ask. You know, there's something going on. Scars from cutting or burning that you're going to see. In boys, we see a lot more broken bones, head injuries, punches, bruises that don't belong. And as you're going through their laundry and you pull their pants and drop them in the washer and out falls a razor blade, that's a sure sign that something's going on. You know, watch for things that don't belong where they are. You know, you've got a razor to shave with in your household bucket where your shampoo and conditioner is. That's a great place for it. When you're finding it on your daughter's floor, randomly in the middle of the floor, that might be a question as to why. So we're going to talk about suicide and teenage deaths. And I think it's important to understand where teenage death comes from before we go in. And you don't need these numbers. They're in my presentation. But an average of about 16,000 teenagers between 12 and 19 die pretty much every year between 99 and 2006. That's not just from suicide. Less than 1% of all deaths that occurred in the U.S. is teenagers. But still, 16,000 is a huge number. The five things that cause death amongst teens are accidents, like car accidents, unintentional injuries, homicide, suicide. And since this, I did this presentation, suicide and homicide have switched. Now suicide is the number two. It's only behind car accidents. And then cancer and heart disease. Accidents account for about half of those 16,000 deaths. But obviously motor vehicle, anybody who knows that's taught a kid how to drive, how dangerous it is, how nerve-wracking it is. So when you look at different socioeconomical groups and stuff like that, non-Hispanic African-American males have the highest death rate when you look at that number. And when you look at homicide, it's the leading death rate for black males, non-Hispanic black males. So the reason I show you this is to give you an idea of just how many kids die roughly every year versus what suicide is doing. So it's just, you know, still teenage death is a small fraction compared to overall death, but it's a huge one because they're healthy for the most part. We don't expect some of the other things to take them. So there's a parent resource program that I really, really like. And they talk about that, and this is where the numbers have shifted from the third to the second, that it is the second leading cause of death for kids between 10 and 24. And I think one of the things to really look at is 10. I have a kid that's 9. I have ones that have already been 10. I can't imagine at that point of them having those thoughts. You know, it's a lot to take in. That it's the second leading cause of death for college age use. You know, that's a huge thing, and still for our 12 to 18s. That more teenagers and young adults die from suicide than from cancer, heart disease, AIDS, birth defects, stroke, pneumonia, influenza, chronic lung disease. You put all those together, and still more die from suicide. That's huge. And there's an average of almost 3,500 attempts for suicide for 9 to 12. And that's just grades 9 to 12. That number still makes me sick. Now, the important thing is that when we talk about suicide, 4 out of 5 kids who attempt suicide give warning signs. So there's hope. There's ways to look for it. So some of the signs we talk about is threats. In the mental health profession, we take every threat serious. There is not a threat that a kid gives me that I don't implement some kind of serious program. Because whether they just say, you know, I shouldn't be here, I'm better off dead, I don't like it here, it's fine. But we take it very seriously. And the interesting thing about this generation is not all threats are said verbally. Sometimes they put them on social media sites. Sometimes they text them. It's not the same as it was like 2 generations ago. So along with those suicidal threats, some of the other warning signs is previous suicide attempts. There, a kid that has tried a suicide attempt before is 100 times more likely the first year after that attempt to try again, which is kind of startling to think about that, okay, my kid's done this, we're moving past, things are looking good. You still gotta watch them really carefully for the next year, which makes moms a little nuts, but if we don't know, we don't know what to look for. So another thing we see in kids with suicide warning signs is they are obsessed with death and suicide. They'll write poems, they'll write essays, they write novels. When you walk into their room, their idols are someone that's committed suicide. You know, those are things that you look for and go, tell me why this is here. What does this mean to you? Why, you know, For some people, it can be therapeutic, but for most of them, it's a warning sign. So when we talk about suicide warning signs, look for plans. If all of a sudden all the ibuprofen disappears in your house, start looking around to figure out why. You know, when you've got a Costco-sized bottle and it just disappears, okay, at my house sometimes I misplace it, but you know, when you're seeing things like that disappearing, watch for it. One of the big signs you see with suicide warnings is they'll give away their most important things, whether it be a video game or a book, or, you know, in case of girls, it might be some jewelry, but you'll see them give away things that have meaning to them. And when they start doing that, that's a huge red flag. That's a big sign that something's wrong. They'll start to say, when you notice them, maybe they're out in an aunt's house, and they say goodbye, and it's not a normal goodbye, it's a tearful, I'm really gonna hug you and hang on tight. And when you start to see those level of goodbyes, that's a sign. When they start saying goodbye to families or friends that is different than their usual, that's a big sign. Warning signs that comes with suicide. Grief that's already there, that's unresolved, like when they lose a relationship or they, you know, their parents get divorced, they have to change their social environment, whether it be that they move or, you know, those are things that can start to head that way because grief left unresolved is a really big deal. You know, kids need help processing through it. And for them, because their worldview is smaller than an adult, a loss of their best friend is their entire world. You know, as an adult, losing a friend is hard, but it's not your entire world. But as an adolescent, your worldview is this big instead of this big. So that loss is a lot. They've actually shown in brain scans that it is physically painful. And so they feel, if you see them talking about feeling abandoned or lonely, that's something to watch for. I like this one. I'm not dead yet. So there are lots of really good resources out there. There's lots of really good stuff that comes, believe it or not, from the United Kingdom, because they put a lot of free resources online. Teens Finding Hope is a great place to start looking. They have lots of really good stuff. One of the things you can do if you think your kid's in that place, have them evaluated. If you do have insurance, most insurance companies will pay to have kids evaluated because it's better for them to catch a problem early than to let it go long term. You know, when we talk about having your kid evaluated, I would never ever attempt to set my child's broken bone. I don't have the skills for that. That's just not my skill set. That's not what I've been trained to do. I wouldn't evaluate my own children, even though I am a therapist. I can look at it and go, ooh, that's some depression right there. I still take them in because it's different to have them evaluated by someone that doesn't have that emotional connection and reaction because they can be much more clear-headed. You know, my mom was a nurse growing up and she would never try to do any of our stuff for us because she had that emotional connection, that emotional attachment. So I always tell people, if you think there's something going there, talk to them first and foremost. And if they're not talking to you, take them in. Get them seen by somebody. There's lots of really good resources. The church has lots of really good resources. But I really like this Teens Finding Hope website. It's great. Another really great website is one, and I can't remember the address off the top of my head, but if you type in STOPP with two P's, it brings up a British website, and they have all kinds of stuff on mental health. Anxiety and depression, they have great worksheets and great explanations on things. It's a fantastic one. When you talk about severely depressed people, sometimes there's a need for inpatient treatment, particularly when you're talking about someone that has suicidal attempts and a suicidal ideation, because unfortunately, until they get out of that headspace, they're not safe in their environment, and you'd be amazed what people have tried to commit suicide with. I'm always amazed, and I see it. So one of the things I always tell people is if you're looking for a therapist, it's best to look for one that specializes in adolescence because adolescence is a little bit different than adults or geriatrics. It's, you know, Do you talk the same way to your teenagers that you talk to your adult friends? Probably not. So when we talk about treatment, I love Eeyore. He's my sad little friend. There's lots of different treatments for any of these disorders. The first one is psychotherapy. And psychotherapy, along with a lot of the talk therapies, are really good for adolescents because a lot of times it's a thinking error. That's what I like to call it. They've got this idea, this is how their thought's going, and if we can interrupt that thought and get it to move to a different place, it changes the way they're thinking and helps. So that ties in with cognitive behavioral therapy. The idea is if we change your thoughts, we change your actions. And a lot of times with adolescents, they respond extremely well to just talk therapy. Sometimes, for some people, medications are needed, and they're best prescribed by a psychiatrist that specializes in it. Sometimes the genetic component in some of these disorders are just so strong that you need some medication. I like to tell people, you're walking along on the beach and you fall in a hole. And it's a really, really deep hole. And you can see that there is light, but there's no way you can get out. There's nothing to stand on. So medication's kind of like a little step stool that you sit down and you can step up on, and then you can crawl out of the hole. But without the step stool, you're just stuck in the dark. So some people, medications is needed. I find for parents, support groups. There are NAMI, which is the National Association of Mental Health, is fantastic. They have support groups all over because it's not just the child that struggles, it's the parents. Because just like they're changing and struggling, you're struggling. You know, you might have a kid that's been doing great, has straight A's, and all of a sudden gets hit with this depression. Their grades fall. They're struggling with just day-to-day stuff. It wears on you as a parent. And it helps to have other parents in the same boat to talk to. They get, you know, some of the greatest ideas you'll get are from other parents that have already been there. That's how you spell NAMI. Most importantly, talk to your kids. If you think they haven't heard about this, I'll tell you they have. Most children are way more aware of mental health issues and things than adults. And talking to them and asking them questions and letting them ask you questions is so important. It's hard. It's not easy. But the more you're open and honest with them about stuff like this, the easier it is for them to come to you. And frankly, you'd rather have them ask you questions than search the internet or ask their friends, because chances are they're going to run across some good stuff, but some really crappy stuff too, and it's not helpful. And don't forget, you know, there really is a strong genetic component to this. So when you see different disorders in families, it's not uncommon to see it in your kids. It's hard as the parent to accept that, but it's not uncommon. And, you know, these are your kids. Just let them know you love them. Let them know that it's okay that they're having this thought, that it's okay they're having this idea, that you're still going to love them. You're still going to be there. You're still going to support them because they need that. You get more flies with honey than with vinegar. So, you know, do it with that love. And then we have a nice little fly that flew by. He's coming to stay. So you can see my little friend at the bottom of the tunnel. It gets better. So I can give you guys a couple of examples because I find it's important to have examples. So I'll tell you about James. James is one of my friends that I like to call them my friends because my patients are all my friends. They're not really, but, you know. When James came to us, he had been very, very abused for a long time, and he was highly suicidal. I think he had had 5 suicide attempts in the past 3 years. He was a very depressed kid, very anxious kid. Just getting him to sit for more than 10 minutes didn't work, so we used to pace for his sessions. But with some meds and with some therapy, he now is 22. He lives on his own. He has a giant bank account. He works construction. He's gone from the bottom up to a supervisor, and he does great. He has a girlfriend. There's hope. And I love to use James as an example because when he came to us, nobody knew what to do with him. He just was in a really bad place. But just because you're there doesn't mean you have to stay there. He was my little anxious kid. And then I have my friend Patricia that before she came to us, when she was in a residential center, she was so depressed that she physically moved slower. Like if you ask her to pick up a paper, it would look like this. And I'm not kidding, it would take that long. So even her physical movements were slower. But a lot of psychotherapy, a lot of talking about what happened to her, drawing it, you know, and working with her. She's not in a residential treatment center anymore. She was able to go back home with her parents. She's doing well. The last I heard from her, she was applying to college. There's hope. You know, just because you're there doesn't mean you have to stay there. I like this quote, hope. Hold on, pain ends. You know, and I like this in particularly when we talk about the Lord. You know, we always have the atonement. It doesn't last forever. There's help. There's hope. There's lots of good things out there. So one of the things I brought you guys, you guys all got a jelly bean. So we're going to do this fun activity. I made your youth do it that... did anybody not get a bag of jelly beans that came in? Okay. So we're going to open your jelly beans. And I'm going to warn you, there are some cinnamon ones in there and some black licorice. So if you don't want either of those flavors, don't choose red or black. But, so what you're going to do is open your jelly beans, and I want you to pick up a jelly bean. And we're going to hold it in your hand. So this exercise is called a mindfulness exercise. And it's one of the great things we use in therapy. Mindfulness is fantastic. So you're going to pick the jelly bean up and hold it in your hand. I want you to look at it. Examine it. What's it look like? What color is it? How would you describe the texture to someone? Now feel the jelly bean. What's it feel like against your skin? Is it soft? Is it smooth? Squeeze it. Is it rough? What do you feel? Now smell your jelly bean. What does it smell like? Now put the jelly bean in your mouth, but don't eat it. What does it feel like on your tongue? What does the texture feel like now? How does it taste? Does it taste the way it smells? Now move it around in your mouth and experience every aspect of it. Now bite your jelly bean. What do you think about the taste? How does it feel in your mouth? Now give yourself a moment to finish eating your jelly bean, and then I want you to tell me how that was. Anybody tell me how that's different than if you just grab a handful and throw them in? Makes you appreciate it a little bit more.
I was focusing just on the jelly bean.
You're focusing just on the jelly bean, yep. So that's what we call a mindfulness activity. Mindfulness is a great way to help yourself with social anxiety, with generalized anxiety, pretty much anything we've talked about today, mindfulness helps with. Because what it does is it gets us out of our head and back into our body, into our sensation. There's a really great app, if you have a smartphone, that you can download called Smiling Mind. It walks you through lots of different mindfulness things, but it kind of helps. It has a little happy cloud symbol.
What is it called?
Smiling Mind.
Smiling?
Smiling. S-M-I-L-I-N-G. Smiling Mind. But it helps with that mindfulness, and I find that especially... if you use it in the morning when you get up and in the evening, it kind of helps bring you back into your body and helps you focus. So, last but not least, questions. You guys can ask me any questions you want. The door's closed, the youth aren't here.
Was there anything else about they don't want it?
So that's one of the things that, if they want it, I think it's a phenomenal to bring in. But if they don't want it, if you force it to bring it in, it won't work. It, you know, unfortunately, adolescents have minds of their own. And I always tell people, I can't force anybody to do anything. I tell my patients that when I treat them. If they're willing to bring in that atonement piece, it is one of the most fantastic things that can help, but only if they're willing. If they're not willing, if you try to bring it in, most of the time they'll just push it away and they won't listen. That's a great question.
So would you recommend you just like let them get therapy and help without any gospel?
If you are taking them to see a therapist, involve them in it if you can. I know there are limits with availability and insurance company and things like that, but talk with them like and sit down with them and say, okay, let's go take you to see someone. But what do you want? You know, if you have that option, the more you involve them, the more they'll engage. And honestly, I'll tell you, the technique of therapy doesn't necessarily matter. It's that connection that they have with their therapist, because that connection is what prompts the change. It's that connection with people. Because I can give you guys all the tools in the world, but it doesn't do you any good if you don't use them. You know, I can hand you a tool to change the tire on your car, but if I don't tell you how to do it and you don't think you can do it, you're not going to do it. Does anybody else have questions?
Let's say you have no experience taking your kid in. Mm-hmm. What can you expect if you, like, say you think your kid is anxious or has depression? What, like, how do you even, you take them in? Do you as a parent talk to the therapist?
So that is that's a really great question. If you think your child's to that point and you need to take them in, what do? Most therapists will want to talk to you because you're going to have a perspective. Your child's going to have a perspective. Most therapists, when you go in, you'll probably get about a 30-page questionnaire. And I'm really not kidding, that asks tons and tons of questions about things. Or they're going to want to sit down with you and say, tell me what you think. And then they're going to want to sit down with your adolescent and say, tell me what you think. And then most likely they'll sit down together. And if they're not doing that, ask for it. A lot of times, depending on the age, the older adolescents, you'll probably be less involved than the younger ones. But ask the therapist, you know, what's your training? What's your background? You know, what are your therapy? What types of therapy do you use? What, you know, what do you do when you have a kid that doesn't want to talk to you? Don't be afraid to ask. Always. That's a great question. Anybody else have a question?
Can I add something to that?
Sure.
I'm actually a therapist too.
Yeah.
And I would say that you're right in that therapists will take themselves with the adolescents most of the time. But it, like when I would do therapy, if an adolescent, I told the parents, I'm not going to tell you what we talk about here until you're ready to do it, unless it is harm to yourself or harm to others, and your parents will know immediately.
Yep.
And as long
or
as
if there is any abuse.
Mm-hmm, yeah,
that's the other. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, because you're a mandated reporter, but I would always let the parents know that I'm going to tell you that, and then we're going to help your child work on telling you the rest of the stuff.
And I will tell you, like she said, oftentimes at the end of a session, if I had an adolescent that had a really rough session, I'm going to tell you as the parent, hey, your kid had a really rough session. Look for these things. You need to keep an eye on this.
Yeah. So how do you go about finding a good match with a therapist?
So that's a very good question. a lot of it, I will tell you, is driven by insurance. In some aspects, you know, you don't have a choice. It's by what your insurance mandates. But you can still call and talk to the therapist. You can look online for Google reviews, although accuracy, it's kind of sketchy. Call and talk to them. Ask for 5 minutes of their time.
Can I share a resource for that, too? So
yeah.
I used to work for LDS Family Services, and a lot of them are moving away from direct one-on-one therapy with people. But they, at least the Frederick, Maryland office, I don't know if all the OMs are doing that. I thought they were moving towards this. They had a list of LDS-friendly therapists, not necessarily LDS, but people who understand our beliefs and respect them and can work with them. And so that is also an excellent place to start, just calling your local LDS Family Services. Most areas have at least one.
Yeah.
And then you can just call, and then that's a good starting point that then you can go off of that.
Last question.
Comment. I was just thinking that there's been times where I just sent my son to a therapist just because I wanted him to have somebody else to talk to besides me, and it really was helpful. And it wasn't like he was necessarily struggling, just the normal struggle.
Sometimes you just need somebody to talk to.
Yeah.
Yes? It depends. It all depends on the insurance. Some will pay for it, some won't.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Latter-day Saint Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.